From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Nearly 17 million Americans have lost their jobs since the COVID-19 pandemic was declared. The unemployment rate has already reached the levels it was during the Great Depression of the 1930s. And yet, all that the administration of President Donald Trump has achieved, along with Congress, is an economic stimulus package that will give Americans up to $1,200 in a single direct payment that is yet to be sent out. Now, some lawmakers are asking, why can't the government simply put money into the hands of workers directly to stave off unemployment? Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal has introduced a new bill called the Paycheck Guarantee Act that will preserve paychecks until the COVID-19 emergency is over, thereby reducing the need for layoffs. The gist of Jayapal's legislation was echoed in an op-ed by Republican Senator Josh Hawley. My guest is Sarah Anderson. She's the director of the Global Economy Project and co-editor of inequality.org at the Institute for Policy Studies. Welcome to the program, Sarah.
Thanks for having me.
So this is something that was also echoed a few weeks ago by the New York Times. I'm not sure if you saw it, but in late March, the New York Times had an interesting op-ed that simply asked, why is America choosing mass unemployment? And it contrasted what the U.S. was doing, which is just simply, you know, choosing these one-time checks, contrasting that with what a lot of European nations have been doing, which is simply continuing people's salaries, maybe not 100%, but 80 or 90%. This seems like an obvious answer, right? So what exactly does Pramila Jayapal propose?
Yes, her Paycheck Guarantee Act would guarantee 100% of wages for workers at companies that have either shut down as a result of the crisis or been significantly harmed by it. And that sounds like a lot of money going to a lot of people, but when you think about it, taxpayers are already going to be on the line for unemployment insurance. And this kind of layoff prevention approach that Representative Jayapal is pursuing has a lot of benefits over just relying on our very creaky unemployment system. First of all, obviously for families and workers, it's preferable to not lose your job at a time of crisis. You can stay on your employer-sponsored health insurance program if you do have that, and you don't have to deal with the kind of trauma that goes along with losing your job at a time like this. For employers, there's a big advantage of it because you don't deal with the kind of disruption that would happen as the economy starts to recover. You'd be able to just bring those workers back. They'd have a, you know, guaranteed job as we start to get things move, the gears turning again and going back to work. And they wouldn't have to deal with all of the expenses and hassles of recruiting new employees, training them, onboarding them. And so I hope that this does get a serious look. Something like this is in the airline bailout for airline employees, at least through the end of September. But broadening it out to many more employees would make a lot of sense and build on some of the lessons we've seen from other countries.
Now, on the airline bailout, isn't it more of a direct payment to the company to keep workers enrolled as opposed to simply giving workers the paychecks directly from the government?
Yeah, well, I have to look more closely at the Jayapal approach, but I think that the airline bailout is definitely the money to the companies with the condition that they do not involuntarily lay off anyone until at least the end of September. Hopefully, you know, things are still dragging on that would be extended. I think the Jayapal approach also is that you would put this money available to companies that would be eligible if they've been harmed by by the crisis, but with the understanding that it is for the purpose of keeping people on their payrolls. And Germany is a company that's a good one to look at. They did this kind of approach very effectively after the 2008 crisis. In their model, they don't give 100%, they give 2/3. Their wages are probably higher in general than in the US. And it meant that the German economy was able to recover much more quickly after the 2008 crash. Their unemployment rate was back down by the end of 2009 to what it had been in 2008. In the US, it took us 4 more years to bring our unemployment level down to what it was before the crash. And that had a lot to do with just those German workers were already on the payroll. They could go right back to work, get things going, no extra cost for the company. And so I really think we should look at that here too.
Right. The Jayapal bill, I understand, would cover, in addition to workers' salaries, essential business expenses like rent. I mean, this seems very much designed to specifically help small businesses, which are, you know, in so many ways, the lifeblood of our economy, right? You have a small mom and pop, say, restaurant or, you know, any kind of local business where if this were law, they wouldn't have to lay off their employees because those employees would continue getting paychecks from the government and they would get help paying their own expenses such as rent and mortgage and could jump right back into normal business once this was over. And our politicians keep talking about wanting to reopen the economy and get back into normal business, but they seem to want to pour money into the top tiers of our economy, right? Rather than directly into small businesses or at the hands of workers.
Well, to be clear, the CARES Act that passed recently, the big $2.2 trillion plan, does have some provisions for small businesses where you can get a loan, and that loan can be forgiven if you use the money for payroll support. That only applies to companies that have 500 employees or less, and it's a limited pot of money. A lot of people are having trouble getting it. The program isn't working out that well so far, and so it really needs to be beefed up. The Jayapal plan would actually be available for private and publicly held companies of all sizes, and so it could also hopefully help prevent some of the really mass layoffs that we've been seeing. And also for companies that have already their workforce. There's a way to have this be retroactive so that they can bring workers back on board and have them recoup some of the lost wages they've already been suffering.
Right. The small business loan program was so overwhelmed on the, you know, first day and even several days after it initially opened that there was, you know, no capacity. The banks who were supposed to be part of this program didn't really have the capacity to handle the application that were coming in, and already Federal Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin has asked for an expansion for an extra $250 billion more for that loan program. This is very reminiscent of the fact that our unemployment claims offices have also been overwhelmed as the, you know, millions upon millions of people every week are trying to file for unemployment benefits. They're having trouble reaching unemployment offices, filing claims online or certainly in person even. And it just seems as though the government is incapable of handling this kind of shock to the system unless it takes action fast. Sarah, they were talking about unemployment levels of the kind we saw during the Great Depression. And during the Great Depression, the government simply directly employed people, right? The Works Progress Administration was born out of this. And I'm wondering why no one's discussed that yet. Is it that they just expect this to be a temporary shock that's artificially caused because we're talking about a virus? And so no one's really talking about direct government employment?
Well, hopefully that kind of public investment for economic recovery is still to come. The thing that makes this situation so different is people can't go back to work. They can't. We can't start putting people
right
on infrastructure projects and all because it's a public health issue. You know, I've thought a lot about my family's experience during the Great Depression. My uncle was part of the Civilian Conservation Corps, where he went out with other young unemployed men and got paid to plant trees and do other kinds of public works projects and like that, and sleeping in, you know, tents with lots of people. And we just can't consider that kind of thing yet. So that's one thing that makes the situation so different. But, you know, you're right. It has been such an eye opener about the fragility of our systems for handling a crisis like this. These stories are like what you would imagine, you know, the poorest of the poorest developing countries struggling to have a functioning government. And that's what we're looking at right now in the richest country in the world.
Right. Yeah, this might be the sort of idea that might gain more traction once it is safe for everybody to end quarantine, if mass unemployment persists, as some are actually imagining that it would, that even if employment levels were to go back down, they would still remain as high as 6%, as opposed to the 3.5%, which was already an underestimate, because that's just the official unemployment rate anyway. So in terms of what is required, in terms of the political will that is required, are you heartened by the fact that Republican Senator Josh Hawley had a similar idea to Pramila Jayapal's? Because these days, everything is so politicized and so partisan that if a Democrat suggests it, Republicans tend to be against it just because Democrats have suggested it. But here you have a Republican senator from Missouri essentially echoing a similar idea in an op-ed in the Washington Post.
I was really heartened by that myself. I do think there should be bipartisan support for this. All of these Republican members are hearing from their constituents about the kind of struggles that they're going through. And it's just common sense to want to do as much as we can to protect people from the, you know, extreme, you know, scarring effects that this crisis is going to have long term. And one way you can really lessen that is keep people on payrolls, have them officially still employed and getting their income and not having to worry about reapplying for jobs. Keep that level of stability until this horrible pandemic passes.
Other countries that I'd mentioned in Europe have done something similar. You said Germany had done something similar during their last recession, and Denmark is putting money into people's hands. Then you have Spain, which is apparently moving toward what looks somewhat like a universal basic income, but permanently. And we had during this past election, the primary election, one candidate, Andrew Yang, whose entire platform was based on universal basic income even before coronavirus and the pandemic we're facing. So certainly it seems as though this idea that the government can and ought to use tax dollars to directly support taxpayers seems to be becoming more and more mainstream, right?
Absolutely. It's amazing to see how fast people's views on this have changed since even just a few months ago. And I do think that on the case of the universal basic income, this could be a time where we experiment with ideas like that and test them out and maybe dispel some of the myths and concerns about them. You know, there are myths about universal basic income that people will just, waste the money and use it for things they don't really need, and
which are never concerns when we talk about throwing money at big businesses and corporate executives.
and it might be a time to test them out, dispel some of the myths about them, and then consider whether they should be permanent policies instead of just something that we do when we have these extraordinary kinds of crises.
A quick aside, I don't know if you saw this, venture capitalist in being interviewed on CNBC made news for suggesting that hedge funds ought to be allowed to be wiped out during this crisis, because the worst thing that'll happen if the government does not come to the rescue of some of these major Wall Street companies is that a few billionaires don't get to summer in the Hamptons. He said, who cares? A hedge fund that serves a bunch of billionaire family offices, let them get wiped out. The CNBC anchor interviewing him just sort of sputtered and couldn't believe what he was hearing. But we just don't hear this being questioned enough, you know, that Wall Street firms, when they don't get, you know, certain kinds of firms in particular, when they don't get bailed out, that is the risk of doing business.
Well, I don't want to say that there's any silver lining to this crisis at all. People are really suffering, and I don't want to say there's anything positive about it, but it does seem to be a moment when people are rethinking questions like, what does it mean to be essential in our economy? I think that it has really opened people's eyes to who really do we need to keep this country running on a day-to-day basis. We're looking at our postal carriers and our grocery workers and warehouse workers and many others in a whole new light, and greatly appreciating the sacrifices and the contributions they're making right now. And at the same time, questioning, the people who are making the most money on Wall Street, are they doing really essential work to keep our economy going? And I think that's a healthy debate to have. It's also a time to reflect on how we were so much less prepared and how the crisis has been so much more painful because of the extreme inequality in this country, and that so many people are off on yachts, as we saw with Geffen, the billionaire, who bragged about being out on his yacht to avoid the crisis.
His $400 million yacht.
Yeah, it wasn't very tasteless at a time when a lot of people are having to get on crowded buses to go to jobs that are benefiting all of us, and hopefully that eye-opening moment won't just be a blip, and it'll help us really rethink what we value in this economy.
You mentioned postal workers, and I know this is an issue that you've written and studied about quite a bit, and I want to focus on that right now, because while delivery drivers and Amazon workers and grocery workers are absolutely getting justifiable attention, we're not hearing as much about our postal workers, who continue to face the same risks that delivery drivers do, are directly employed by the government, as we were talking about earlier with direct government employment, but are really not getting as much attention. The $2.2 trillion economic stimulus package did have some relief for the Postal Service. And I understand that you think that this is not nearly enough, that in fact, Republicans stripped down a lot of the initial relief that was placed in there by Democrats.
Yes, the Postal Service is in a dire crisis at the moment. There are predictions that if they do not get an emergency cash infusion, they could collapse as early as June. And that is so crazy at a time when their role is more essential than ever. They're straining to meet the skyrocketing demand for home deliveries of essential things like medicine and food and cleaning supplies. But the mail revenue that they rely on is absolutely plummeting. It could drop by as much as, or even more than 50% this year. And so they are facing a severe financial crisis. President Trump was asked about this at one of his briefings, and he was utterly dismissive. He basically said the Postal Service brought its problems on itself, and he was completely unsympathetic. And the real motivation here is that the Trump administration has been trying to cripple the Postal Service for years now, because they would like to privatize it, sell it off to private corporations. This would be devastating for every community in this country which has a postal service, and but particularly rural areas that are completely dependent on the postal service. So they're trying to use the crisis as leverage to push through a political agenda of weakening the public postal service, undercutting their unions. This has been a source of middle-class jobs, particularly for African Americans, for decades now. And so it's really time for people to stand up and defend the public postal service.
And what has the Trump administration's response been? Because, part of the function that the Postal Service serves is to offer affordable, mailing, the affordable mailing of packages and letters, et cetera, for the American people. And that's why it's directly subsidized or directly, but it's also a service that pays for itself. And Trump's answer was, I understand, raise your prices.
The Postal Service focuses on affordability and universality. They deliver to every family in this country. There is nobody else who can do that. People in urban areas might be used to seeing FedEx and UPS pull up to deliver packages to their home. The Postal Service is the only one that goes to every home in America, and nobody else is going to be able to build that kind of network. And yeah, his response was just charge people more. And that is just outrageous at a time when people are relying on the Postal Service for getting their pharmaceuticals, their daily needs, when they're being ordered to stay at home. And so it's just absolutely outrageous that he is so dismissive of their concerns. The only thing they got out of the $2.2 trillion legislation was the possibility of borrowing more from Treasury, but with a lot of conditions that would include draconian cuts on the service. And so there's actually bipartisan support for a much bigger cash relief package, but Treasury Secretary Mnuchin and President Trump are not allies on this, and people really need to stand up and put pressure on Congress to come through and save our public postal service. This was, you know, created through our Constitution to have a service that could help bind the nation, and it has done so much for the American people over these hundreds of years, and we cannot afford now to let the postal service collapse.
And the ideological hostility that Republicans express toward the Postal Service is basically because this is a publicly funded service and they would like to see essentially everything privatized, right? They hate the idea of a government subsidized service that competes with private businesses. But of course, as you suggested, private businesses go to where the profits are. They're not conducting a service, they're making profits.
Exactly. And to be clear, taxpayers have not been subsidizing the Postal Service. Mm. They have been self-funded through their stamps and, you know, rates that they charge on packages. But they don't want to gouge people at a time like this. They should not be encouraged to gouge people. And it's an ideological hostility towards public sector workers who, you know, should not be apologizing for making a living wage. They should not, you know, be pressured to turn into a Walmart model where everyone is, not everyone, but many people are having to rely on public assistance because the wages are so bad. We should be proud that we have a public postal service that pays people halfway decent middle class wages. And what's particularly crazy is that the Republicans who represent rural areas where they are completely reliant on the postal service. You know, my sister-in-law runs a little business in a small town in Minnesota. She does all of her shipping to her clients through the Postal Service. Where would she be without that? And so it's just, it's an insane ideological attack on a public service that makes absolutely no sense at any time, and certainly not now when we need them more than ever.
Thank you for the correction on the subsidizing. Absolutely. And there's this, you've written about this before, I know, but there's definitely rules that have been rigged against the Postal Service to force them to have massive reserves that have essentially been attempts to impoverish the service itself to try to put it out of business. But that's a topic for another conversation. Sarah, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Really appreciate your time. We'll post a link to your article from our website. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
My guest has been Sarah Anderson. She is the director of the Global Economy Project and co-editor of inequality.org at the Institute for Policy Studies. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.